Good afternoon, friends. On behalf of the members of First Church of Christ Scientists, Mesa, Arizona, it is a joy to welcome you to this Christian Science lecture entitled, What Are We Looking For? Our lecturer, Martin Brunis of Beverly Hills, California, is a member of the Board of Lectureship of the Mother Church, the First Church of Christ Scientists in Boston, Massachusetts. He is well qualified to speak to us on this topic, for from his childhood, Mr. Brunis has pursued varied careers in music, in the motion picture industry, and in other areas of the performing arts. His accomplishments include a debut as a concert pianist at Carnegie Hall, organization and direction of the first music department for the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios, and creation and production of the original Hallmark greeting card show. In 1948, Mr. Brunis withdrew from the business world to devote his full time to the practice of Christian Science healing. He became an authorized teacher in 1958 and has lectured extensively throughout the world in several languages. I feel sure that today his message will help make us more aware of what we are really looking for and help us discover how we can find it. It is indeed a privilege to present Mr. Brunis.
I'm not going to let Mrs. Fairfield go right away. That's one of the lovingest, richest, warmest, and most comprehensive introductions I've ever received. Okay. And thank you very much. Not only given beautiful, but looks beautiful, doesn't it? It's a great pleasure to be back here in beautiful Arizona. And I don't know how many of you have ever been to the Big Sur in Northern California or have seen the cliffs of Laguna in the south. But if you have, then you'll understand why, when driving down the beautiful California coast late one Sunday afternoon, we stopped our car on a promontory high above the Pacific Ocean. Seagulls careened through space, down past the cliff sides, then swiftly skyward on updrafts of air. Far below, green waves moved in patient succession and crashed against the gray rock. On the horizon, a sunset of dazzling reds and oranges turned slowly to a shimmering purple. A crescent moon and the planet Venus sparkled against the sky. After drinking in the sight, we turned our car around to drive away, and my wife and I noticed two other couples who had stopped there. One couple stood transfixed and speechless, spellbound by the glory of the scene, the radiance of the sunset, the rhythm and color of the sky, the spray, and the sea. We felt that, like ourselves, they had found the beauty they were looking for, which the California coastline holds for all. The second couple stood with their backs to the view. Instead of taking in the grandeur of the sunset and the shimmering loveliness of the sea, they were looking at their dilapidated old car. And they were arguing heatedly. The husband wanted to sell the car, but his wife wanted to keep it and paint it chartreuse or wild canary. They were so absorbed in their own personal problems that they couldn't see the beauty all around them, the magnificence of the horizon, which we had driven miles to see, held no interest for them. They missed its beauty because they were not looking for it. How often does each one of us miss the beauty around us just because we are not looking for it? In the press and bustle of modern life, do we ever stop to ask ourselves, what are we looking for? That is one of the most fundamental questions in human life. An honest answer to this question will reveal what is important to us, what we consider worthwhile. In fact, what we are looking for in life will shape our entire experience. What we are looking for in life, in ourselves and in others, will shape our entire experience. What are you looking for? Christian Science asks the person who is ill, are you looking for health in medicine or mind? It asks the person who is unemployed, are you looking for a way to use your intelligence and skills, or are you simply looking for a job? What are you looking for? Christian Science asks the youth, we hear so much about today. Are you looking for happiness just in the companionship of others or in the expression and sharing of your own fine qualities? And what about a sense of home? So many people are looking for a sense of security in home today. What are they really looking for? And how can they find it? Let us together consider these questions and the answers that Christian Science provides. But I can tell you right now that all of these answers stem from the truth of man's at-one-ment with God. This science shows that our at-one-ment with God gives us health. It gives us employment. It gives us happiness and security. When we are at one with God, we are at home. In the textbook of Christian Science, we find this comforting assurance, Pilgrim on earth, thy home is heaven. Stranger, thou art the guest of God. What are we looking for? And how can we find it? Christian Science shows each one of us how to find the good he is looking for by finding his at-one-ment with God through prayer. The Bible is full of accounts of men who understood what they were looking for and found it through prayer. For instance, I'm sure that most of you are familiar with the Bible story of Jacob and Esau. As you know, they were twin sons of the Hebrew patriarch Isaac. Esau was the older son, so inherited all his father's possessions. Jacob got Esau to sell the inheritance to him. Then he deceived his father into giving him the blessing which went with the inheritance. You can imagine how Esau felt taught his twin brother after that, and why Jacob was glad to leave home and find a wife amongst his mother's people in a distant land. But the time came when Jacob wanted to go home. So, taking his family and possessions with him, he went back to face his brother Esau, to whom he sent messengers in advance. As he approached their meeting place, dreading and expecting Esau's vengeance, Jacob turned to God in prayer in his great need. From that prayer came a spiritual experience which so changed what he was looking for that it changed his nature and gave him the new name of Israel. The Bible story reads, and Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. Having seen God Jacob could see himself and Esau at one with God, good. He no longer looked for evil in Esau or himself. And we further read in the Bible that Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him. And they wept. Jacob found love where he looked for malice. He found peace where it anticipated warfare. Through prayer, he saw God good and thus found good expressed in his brother. The change in what he was looking for preserved his life. In 1866, Mary Baker Eddy discovered Christian Science. Like Jacob, she was at a crucial point in her human life. Her past history had been one of invalidism, lack, and loss. She carried this afflictive history with her as she looked through the half-light of hope for answers to her search for happiness and health. But she didn't find them. Then, when she was faced with a severe spinal injury which threatened her very life, she too turned to God in prayer. She too saw God face to face, and her life was preserved. In what must have been a moment of great spiritual illumination, she turned to the Bible, and she was healed through reading the account of Jesus' healing of the palsied man in the 9th chapter of Matthew. In the succeeding years, as she applied the truth she had discovered to all manner of human problems, Mrs. Eddy wrote down her thoughts. Then she rewrote and revised them, each time more fully elucidating her meaning, getting to the heart of each idea. Her textbook, Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures, from which I've already quoted, emerged and grew into a monumental work on Christian metaphysics. And all the while, this woman's metamorphosis was going on. As with Jacob, the new identity of the discoverer and founder of Christian Science appeared. Timidity gave way to courage, self-distrust to confidence. The frail invalid who had looked for answers in so many places finally found the key to health and happiness by finding her own true being in her at-one-ment with God. And she devoted the remainder of her long life on earth to the science of God and to mankind. In the Christian Science textbook, Mrs. Eddy shows us how to find the health and happiness that came to her as she was healed. This healing power is available to all who look to God as she did. I would like to describe a Christian Science healing of a severe physical condition which I know about firsthand. A young friend of mine who had been champion wrestler in college suddenly found himself completely paralyzed from the waist down. The best medical attention was sought, and every physical means was employed in the effort to restore his activity. But the doctors not only couldn't promise him any return to his previous health, they gave him very little hope for life itself. It was at this point, on the recommendation of a friend, that this young man called on a Christian Science practitioner for help. The practitioner turned at once to the Bible and explained to the young man that this book sets forth the basis for spiritual healing. In fact, that it was through turning to the Bible that Mrs. Eddy found her discovery and found her healing. She found her healing and her discovery through the Bible. The practitioner went on to explain that according to the first chapter of the Bible, God made man in His image and likeness. And God saw everything that He had made. And it was good. It was so good that it did not and could not deviate one iota from its creator, its only source, God, good. It was as exact as a reflection in a mirror. Now, a reflection just has to be exactly like a source. So unless God could be disabled, it wasn't possible for the young man to be disabled. The practitioner told him that irrespective of what seemed to him to be the condition of his body, as the image and likeness of God, he could not, even if he wanted to, get away from his perfect activity, his unrestricted, unimpaired action. The young man sat quietly considering what he was hearing. Then suddenly he got up from his chair and, scarcely dependent on his crutches, went out to his car, which was parked in the driveway. Then he proceeded to pull off a metal plate attached to the car next to his license plate. He had served in the armed forces, and this plate described his governmental rating of total disability, which entitled him to compensation from the government. With the glimpse of his true manhood had come the realization that he could no longer accept this label of disabled physical identity. He had a new found rating in God's creation, described to him by the practitioner as incorporeal, inorganic, spiritual man. He couldn't be both. What was he looking for? Wasn't he really seeking his spiritual identity? Well, he found it, and his life was preserved as he accepted his identity as the child of God with joy and confidence. A short time later, he was married and leading a happy, normal life. When this young man repudiated the false concept of himself as a materially minded mortal with a deteriorating physical body and claimed his true self as God's likeness, he not only found health, but happiness and home as well. He had found his at-one-ment with God. Christian Science says to each one of us, the good that you are looking for is to be found in God and is expressed in your own true identity. Set out upon the divine adventure of finding God and your own true being. Put off self-condemnation and self-depreciation. Forgive yourself for past mistakes. Forget past wrongs. Abandon old regrets and sad retrospection. Live life as it is meant to be lived, joyously. Orient your existence not to past errors, but to present good. Value yourself, and others will value you. You know it's right to want and expect to be valued correctly, and there is always the right way to achieve it, by claiming and expressing one's true self. I once witnessed a ludicrous performance of the opposite approach, and I'd like to tell you about it. Some years ago, a friend of mine and I sat down to dinner in a quaint little restaurant in New York. The waitress bustled up, gave us our menus, and said, I hope I didn't keep you waiting. I'm so scatterbrained sometimes, I don't know what I'm doing. In a little while, she came and took our order. As she left us the second time, she said, I hope I get your order right. I'm so stupid. I'm always mixing things up. My friend and I assured her that we were not worried. She was evidently satisfied with our confidence in her and hurried away. When she served the dinner, she came to our table with both arms expertly, yes, expertly balancing several dishes. To show my admiration, I said to her, "My, to be a waitress, you really have to be ambidextrous, don't you?" With a sad look, she replied, "Yes, I know. Does it show?" In trying to explain to her what I meant, I answered, "But to do your kind of work requires a high aptitude." She looked puzzled, shrugged her shoulders, and said, "Well, I guess you're right, but I've always been afraid of height." After she finished setting the meal before us, she said, "It's a wonder I made it to the table without dropping something. I'm so clumsy. I'm always tripping over my big feet." But I said, surely you must realize that you are very deft." "Yes," she said, "I know my hearing is not what it used to be." Later, when I paid the bill, she handed me the change, saying apologetically, "You'd better see I gave you the correct change. When it comes to arithmetic, I'm a first-class nincompoop." I assured her that her services, as well as the restaurant, were very good. But she just kept shaking her head and said, "How can you say that about me and this place?" Well, the truth of the matter was, this woman was an excellent waitress. She did her job well, but she didn't value herself rightly. She was needing and wanting appreciation to compensate for her lack of self-esteem, but she was going about getting it in the wrong way. She needed to look for her worth, her usefulness, her ability in a true spiritual identity, which was at one with God. When each one comes to know his true identity, he discovers the good he is really looking for. Christ Jesus gave the world a magnificent example of someone knowing what he was looking for. Before starting out upon his ministry, he was baptized in the River Jordan. Then he went into the wilderness and remained there 40 days without food. During this time, he carried on a warfare with the suggestions that came to his thought regarding his mission in the world, how he should best make use of the spiritual powers with which he was endowed, what he would look for in the world. Humanly speaking, Jesus lived only 33 years, but he lived as no other man has ever lived, with a relish for life and love for his fellow man. He was not looking for material success, yet his works were mighty, and his words have endured through 19 centuries. He was not looking for material wealth, yet his needs were always met, from his seamless robe to the tax money when he needed it. Nor was Jesus looking for personal power, place, or prestige. And yet no man, before or since this master teacher and healer, has possessed such poise, wielded such authority, occupied such prominence as did this gentle Nazarene. Jesus was looking for and finding in others what he himself expressed, the perfect man of God's creating. Mrs. Eddy writes in Science and Health, "Jesus beheld in science the perfect man who appeared to him where sinning mortal man appears to mortals. In this perfect man, the Savior saw God's own likeness and this correct view of man healed the sick. Jesus healed sick bodies and diseased limbs because he was looking for the perfect man created in God's own likeness. He was looking at humanity through the lens of love. His correct view of man served to blot out the distortions of physical sense and replace them with expressions of harmony. When we hold this view of man, as we look out upon the world, we are obeying Jesus' commandment to love our neighbor as ourself. Holding to this view, we find ingrained prejudices and opinions falling away from our thinking. Our neighbor becomes to us an object of compassion and interest. He no longer appears as an object of criticism, judgment, envy, resentment, or gossip. Loving our neighbor as ourself means that we are seeing the perfect man in him as in ourself. Jesus' total view of himself, his universe, and man was a view pervaded by unutterable love. Love filled the heart of Jesus and is shown with a healing radiance on everything and every body. This love was his expression of the Christ, which manifests the eternal divine nature of God. It is this Christ love that Christian Science brings to bear upon all human problems. This science demonstrates the never-ending nature of the same divine love that Jesus expressed. God is love, and there is no priority on God's love by persons or periods in history. The Christ, as God's divine manifestation, is now and forever the ageless power of love. It is the power that links all periods in God's design for good. Today, as in Jesus' time, healing results from the action of this Christ love as it leads us to look through the lens of love and see man's perfection as the image of God, thus finding man's at-one-ment with God. I'm sometimes asked, how can we see man's perfection when we are faced with a shocking material picture, such as, say, an accident? What can we do in such a situation? I will tell you what one couple did when their son was critically injured in a highway accident. The parents, friends of mine, were many hundreds of miles from home at the time. There they received the news that their 17-year-old son had been struck by a bus as he rode his Honda motorbike into an intersection and had been thrown 14 feet. Because they were out of town and the other members of the family were away from home too, their son had been taken to the hospital, X-rays made before anyone could be notified, and the doctors said he was very critically injured. The first thing his parents did after hearing this news was to call a Christian Science practitioner. He told them that they must look at once for a blessing and not agonize over the accident. He assured them that the boy could only experience spiritual growth through this testing time, and that his full restoration to health was according to God's law of perfect being. He urged them to look for the boy's innate perfection and expect a manifestation of good from this experience. He urged them to pray. And how those parents prayed. They will never forget that night, nor do they want to. For it was full of spoken and unspoken thoughts of gratitude and love. Together they voiced the perfection and love of God and his tender care for his children. The practitioner, too, remained up all night praying for the young man. During this all-night vigil, the parents' thoughts were always with their son, and sometimes they wept. But when they prayed for help, they received it, always remembering that in his real being, this boy was God's perfect child. By morning, these parents were completely free from anxiety or fear. They said that as they went home, they felt they were flying on wings of love. They went straight to the hospital, where they found that their son had made rapid recovery. He no longer needed intensive nursing care, although the x-rays showed a fractured skull, broken ribs, and a broken neck. During his stay in the hospital, he was given no medication, and he had no bandages. As for his broken bones, the specialist told his mother, "I meant to put him in a cast. Then I thought of a brace. Then I decided against even taping him, because his bones went back as though they were glued. I've never seen anything like it." 1 week from the day he was taken to the hospital, the boy came home in his father's car, fully dressed, and walked up the front steps unaided. He returned to college at the end of the summer and was ready and eager for the basketball season. And he earned his letter that year. The effect of this healing reached into every segment of his life. His mother had occasion to write me about this healing sometime later. She said never, by any stretch of imagination, was he an outstanding student, but he amazed his teachers and delighted us by regularly making A's. It would seem that for every one of his weaknesses, Christian Science has given him strength. So don't you see, my friends, when we spiritually understand how to look only for good, we find it through the application of God's law of love. Adversity is turned into gladness. No human experience, however severe, is what it appears to be. It can be turned into an angel that brings a blessing instead of a curse. In God's plan of perfection, there are no conflicting purposes to produce accidents. There are no collisions of material forces or objects to cause injury or death. There is only the continuous unfoldment of man's at-one-ment with God. I'm sometimes asked, again, can these truths that you use in cases of disease and accident be applied to the problem of unemployment? My answer is, what are we looking for in employment? Well, the salient fact about anyone's employment is the great truth that God governs man's life. God, divine mind, the supreme, unerring intelligence is manifested through our own reflected wisdom, our intuitive knowing of what we need to know at any time. This was proved in the experience of a young man in the engineering department of one of the major airlines. He was a Christian Scientist and had learned through Christian Science how to claim the intelligence which belonged to him through his reflection of God. The airline was faced with a problem involving the use of several $1 million worth of equipment. They've been having a great deal of difficulty with it, and he was asked by the executives to try to straighten it out, claiming the intelligence with which God had endowed him. He was able to analyze and break down the problem so that it could be programmed on a high-speed electronic computer. The company was about to invest over $1 million in additional equipment to be utilized for a new fleet of aircraft. But the results from the computer program showed that it was not necessary to do so. As a reward for his work on this problem, the young man was named the Line Maintenance Man of the Year by the airline and later given a new position as industrial engineer, although he lacked the requirement of an engineering degree. This barrier to business advancement was broken as he claimed the divine intelligence which led him to the solution of his company's problem. This young man's achievement is of special interest and importance, and it was at a time when electronic devices were so drastically reducing the number of persons who were being employed. These mechanical devices were then objects of fear and dread to many, many persons whose livelihood depended upon labor. But the electronic computer, instead of putting the young man out of work, served to open up a higher position for him as he used the intelligence with which God had endowed him to meet his company's need. He proved that progress is inescapable as one claims the intelligence that God gives to man. When we subdue the suggestions of educational deficiency, age barriers, retirement, favoritism, and personal influence, we stand in the direct line of progress. No longer do we need to look to personal favor or seniority, to past accomplishment, or to future chances for promotion. Instead, we find that God is the promoter of man. God-governed employees seek arbitration and business settlements through the application of God's law of justice and of love, while they embrace every constructive new idea. God-governed employment makes work burdens light. A person who acknowledges God's government in his work meets personal demands with the capabilities bestowed on him by God. He doesn't fear the possibility of a labor turnover, nor resent an unwanted assignment. The demonstration of God's government in business is the exterminator of all employment problems, when one knows that what he is looking for is found in man's at-one-ment with God. Now, you know, this same truth applies to the demonstration of happiness and home. As we claim our at-one-ment with God and thus establish God's government in our lives, we find good manifested progressively not only in our characters, but also in our relationships and our environment. A young friend of mine who has solved the problem of unemployment and found his place in the business world told me that he wanted a home and family. Though he had worked out the problem of unemployment, he couldn't seem to work this other problem out. I asked him, what are you looking for? He said, well, my concept of home begins and ends with finding a nice girl to marry. I said to him, aren't you beginning at the wrong end of the equation? You're beginning with a girl. That's an effect instead of a cause. Now, I don't mean to deprecate the girl of your dreams, but you must first establish home as a spiritual reality, as a fact of your own identity and spiritual completeness. Your home is to be found in your at-one-ment with God. Your real identity includes the qualities of God, such as honesty, meekness, faith, temperance, and affection. This young fellow and I agreed that this was where he would take off. He promised to start cultivating more of the qualities of God in his character. We both realized that as he expressed the quality of affection, he would not only be attracted to, but he would also be attracted by someone who was reflecting true affection. He saw that heretofore he had been outlining in his own personally limited terms what a home should be, what a wife should be, and in what order they should come. He saw that he had not been acknowledging the fact of God's completeness, and consequently his own completeness as God's likeness. Then he saw that all he had to do was to accept and reflect God's completeness, and that this would meet his human need. As this truth expanded in his thought, he was led to buy a beautiful little house with a lovely yard. Not long after this, he realized that a fine girl, whose friendship he had enjoyed, was expressing the same qualities he was now aware of in himself. Well, you all know the ending. Boy meets girl. Boy gets girl. Or should I say, girl gets boy? And a home, too. That is one kind of companionship, and a very happy one at times. With Christian Science to help in its unfoldment, it often leads to many fruitful years for both companions. But marriage doesn't always mean happiness right now. How many married couples look for happiness in the future, when their house will be paid for, when their children will have finished college, when they can retire on Social Security? They are looking for a happiness on a deferred payment plan. But happiness should be now, not later. Christian Science shows us that happiness comes from our at-one-ment with God. This at-one-ment is expressed in our contentment with good, our peaceful thinking, our gentle ways. Happiness is a pleasure in our own being, a delighting in our spiritual completeness. It is our joy in living and our loving of life. This is our happiness. This is our home. This is our heaven. As we have already quoted from Science and Health, Pilgrim on earth, thy home is heaven. Stranger, stranger, thou art the guest of God. We cherish this spiritual sense of home, which meets our need for security and peace. And we take it with us when we move from place to place, to assume new jobs, to engage in new relationships, wherever we go, whenever we go. Our happiness, our heaven, our home is with us. Once, when I was traveling abroad in the winter, I had an opportunity to prove that wherever we go, whenever we go, our home is with us. In the city where I was staying overnight, it was cold, dreary, and damp. The only hotel room I could find was very, very small and not heated. The bath was not connected with my room, but was at the end of a long, cold corridor, poorly lighted. My room had one lone 40-watt light bulb hanging unadorned on a wire from the ceiling. As I sat on the side of the bed in my overcoat, I suddenly was aware of a dense fog filling the room. I couldn't see a thing through the window. It was all steamed up. I went over and rubbed it, and then I could see out. There was a narrow little sidewalk, just about a foot wide, and people walking by right next to my window. The weather was clear outside. My breathing had caused the fog in the room, and it had steamed up the window. I must admit I was tempted to be discouraged and critical, too. Actually, very critical. Why didn't they have a decent hotel? Why didn't they have proper heating? Why? By that time, I steamed up the window again. Though I didn't have to look out anymore. Then to compound my predicament, I found out that there was no dining room in the hotel, and there were no public restaurants in the town. Obviously, I hadn't learned my lesson, as I was still indulging in criticism, resentment, self-pity, and self-justification. I thought, why should I be subjected to this sort of thing? No heat, no food. I'd never heard of anything like this. I had a bad case of eye trouble. Then I remembered about the man who came to a practitioner for help. The practitioner started to explain to him that there is only one I, or us, and that one is God. But the man kept interrupting, saying, yes, but I know, but I think, and I did, and I'm sure, and I this, and I that, and I. Finally, when the man had to stop talking from sheer exhaustion and lack of breath, the practitioner grasped the opportunity to get a word in edgewise and said, if you won't get off the throne, will you at least move over and let God sit next to you? As I sat there in that dreary little room, I began to declare gratitude for the perfection that I knew was everywhere. I decided to look for perfection and good in everything around, and to love people in this city and this country. I threw out all thoughts of criticism, and I felt at peace. Then the hotel porter knocked at my door and said that a lady by the name of Potts was waiting for me in the lobby. She told him that she was a friend of one of my distant relatives. I hurried to the lobby, and there she was, a lovely little lady in lavender with little white curls all over her head. Before I could say anything, she told me that she knew how critical Americans were of the poor food, bad service, and lack of heating in her country. So she had prepared a dinner that would please even an American. And she had come to fetch me and take me to her home. Well, right there, right then, I decided that I was going to show her how uncritical an American could be and how grateful. So I accompanied her to the feast she had prepared. And it was a feast with pickles and onions and all kinds of meats, potatoes, tomatoes, cabbage and beets, and many, many other ingredients which I never did recognize, all mixed up in a huge glass bowl. And on each side of the table, there were two electric heaters aimed directly at my chair. Oh, and they were going full blast. Many times over, I said, thank you, this is certainly a treat, thank you. I know I was showing her that I had no criticism, and she was no longer criticizing Americans for being critical. Both of us were loving our neighbor as ourselves. The conclusion of the story is that I rose from the table, partly because I could eat no more, and partly to get away from those electric heaters. And I went to the door. I turned to her with so much gratitude and said, Thank you. Oh, thank you so much for your kindness, Mrs. Potts. It isn't Mrs. Potts, she said. It's Miss Potts. I said, oh, I'm sorry. She said, you're sorry. Well, we didn't need to be sorry. Hadn't we been viewing each other through the lens of love, finding our home in heaven? And now aren't we all seeing that we are at home when we are at one with God? And that is heaven. So what are we looking for? This book, Science and Health, makes it very clear. It tells us each successive stage of experience unfolds new views of divine goodness and love. As we go forward in human experience, we do have our choice of views, our choice of what we are looking for. It is either the perfect view of God's creation here and now, as the satisfying expression of the beauty and grandeur of God, or it is the imperfect view that calls life material and evil. What we are looking for will determine what we see. It will also determine what we are, whether it be the radiant reflection of God or a worried, fearful mortal in a very worried world. There are many human concepts of being, but there is only one view that allows for the living of abundant life. That is the view set forth in the Bible, where we are told that God made man in his image, and God saw everything that he had made, and it was good. My friends, the fact of man's present perfection as the image and likeness of God is the promontory from which I urge you to look out upon the world. Look out from it upon yourself. Know yourself as God's perfect man. Delight in your own spiritual being. See yourself in God's endless kingdom rising higher and higher and higher through ever-expanding views of God and man. What are we looking for? Our perfect selfhood. How do we find it? By finding God, who is wholly good, and ourself as God's perfect child. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Thank you.